Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're starting to hear more from survivors of the Orlando shooting. Several of them held a press conference today at the hospital that's treating most of the survivors. Angel Colon, a Framingham native, spoke about what it was like inside the club.
Everyone started running everywhere. I got trampled over. All I could do was just lay down there while everyone was just running on top of me, trying to get to where they had to be. And I can hear the shotguns closer, and I look over and he shoots the girl next to me. And I'm just there laying down. I'm thinking, I'm next. I'm dead.
Angel was shot in the hand and hip, and he spoke today sitting in a wheelchair. Hospital officials said six of the people injured in the shooting are still critically injured, while another five are in guarded condition. Now, in response to the Orlando shooting, maybe you remember seeing some of these images of thousands of people lining up to give blood over the weekend. And on Sunday, Orlando City Commissioner Patty Sheehan told MSNBC this.
I understand that the blood banks are accepting blood from everyone, because I think that's appropriate right now, because there has been a ban on gay men donating blood, and I think it's appropriate right now. You can screen the blood, and maybe this tragedy is the one thing that took that ban away.
Well, Patty Sheehan was incorrect, and the One Blood Donation Center quickly corrected her, tweeting that all FDA guidelines remain in place, meaning that no gay man who hasn't been celibate for at least 1 year can give blood. And of course, that led to a great deal of frustration felt by many members of the LGBT community, and it also prompted questions on whether or not the FDA should lift the ban and what that might mean. So here to help us understand this issue is Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Meghna.
So over the past couple of days, we've seen this outpouring of support, obviously, for the victims in Orlando. But you say there's a controversial issue here as well.
Well, yes, there is. I mean, you can understand that, of course, everyone is just overwhelmed with this desire to help after such a horrible event. But so you can also imagine the frustration that met some people if, say, you want to give blood to help the victims, but you're told that you can't because you're a gay man, and you're not celibate. Jared Polis, who's a gay congressman from Colorado, even tweeted, "We must overturn the morally bankrupt / dangerous ban on gay people giving blood. It's absurd that someone can't even donate blood to their own husband."
Yeah. And I was seeing tweets of people saying that it's easier for a gay man to buy an assault weapon than it is to donate blood to people in need. So obviously a lot of attention on this issue right now. But from your reporting, I mean, it was already brewing.
It was already brewing. So here's the backstory. These regulations were put into place way back a generation ago, back at the start of the AIDS epidemic. It was basically a lifetime ban on giving blood if you were a gay man, which back then was understandable, right? You might be carrying HIV. And remember, actually, you're probably too young, but we were told that it can take months for the HIV to be detectable.
So I'm flattered, but I'm not too young.
Yeah, okay. So the FDA put in a lifetime ban on gay men donating blood. Now, more recently, just last December, the FDA revised its rule, and it said you can give blood if you're a gay man, but only if you've been celibate for the last 12 months, if you've had no sex with any other man over the last 12 months. Now, that's widely seen as progress. At least it's better than a lifetime ban, but it's not enough for some activists. I spoke with Jay Franzone. He's a senior at LaSalle College here in Newton, and he's the spokesman for a group called the National Gay Blood Drive, and they've been pushing since 2013 for the ban on gay men giving blood to be lifted.
When gay men can't give blood, we lose 2-4% of the potential blood supply. And that means we can't save as many lives. And in situations like the Orlando massacre, we lose the ability to respond rapidly to crises. And so we have lines of people out the blood donation center door, and half of those people are being turned away because they can't actually give blood.
But Carrie, help me clarify. I mean, what does Jay think about the new FDA guidelines? I mean, why does he think that that's not enough?
Well, he says they are progress. But first of all, it takes time for them to be put into practice. And in a lot of blood donation centers, they're not in practice yet. The centers have to train up their staffs, change their computer systems. But the argument is also that it's discriminatory, that basically you're in a category of gay men, you're banned in a blanket way, when in fact, the level of risk that you pose as possibly carrying HIV should be based on your individual behavior and not on whether you belong to this group. So you could be a gay man who's been in a monogamous relationship with an HIV negative person for a very long time. You could be a heterosexual person who's been having a lot of high risk sex or injecting drugs. And so it's just they see it as discriminatory.
I see. But I gather that it's not only gay men who are under this blanket ban, this requirement of being celibate for 12 months. People who've had transfusions or otherwise been exposed to other people's blood also have to wait 12 months before they can donate.
That's right. And you can totally understand that as a societal goal, we want to have a safe blood supply. But the point is that gay men are the only group who have been banned as a group. So when you go in to give blood, you're usually asked to fill out a questionnaire, like where you've traveled and what medications you're taking and so on. And again, they're arguing that the level of your risk should be determined by your own individual behaviors and not by what group you belong to.
Right. And Carrie, the original ban went in, just to remind folks, because I think it's important to underscore this, back in the 80s, in the height of the AIDS epidemic, when the gay community was really struck hard by this. And technology was different then. I mean, we're decades later. So, you know, tell me about the state of the art when it comes to testing the actual blood when people go in to donate.
Right. So we have come a long way on testing the actual blood. The science has come a long way. I spoke with Sean Cahill. He's the director of health policy research at the Fenway Institute. And he says there have been a couple of main technological improvements in testing blood for communicable diseases.
There's a nucleic acid test that is used to screen blood after it's been donated. And that can typically detect the presence of HIV now in just about 9 to 11 days after infection.
So you can see the gap there, 9 to 11 days, but the rule says you have to not have had sex for a year. That's a big difference. And then also Cahill says there are new technologies called pathogen inactivation technologies. So basically, you know, even if there are problematic viruses or bacteria in there, they can treat the blood and try to kill them. So basically, the blood supply in general is a lot safer from HIV than it used to be.
Right. And the 9 to 11 days after infection of being able to detect HIV, that's a huge change. I mean, it used to take months, right? Decades ago.
Yes,
okay.
That is a huge change.
So really some profound advancements in the technology or detection technology for blood samples. But what about the overall argument that men who have sex with men have a heightened risk of being potential HIV carriers?
Right. And that's the complex issue, right? And Sean Cahill says, yes, that's true. 15% of gay men are HIV positive, but 85% are HIV negative. So that's why it makes more sense to judge someone based on their individual risk factors.
I see. So ultimately, Carrie, it seems that one of the repercussions of the awful atrocity that happened in Orlando might be that it's casting more light on this issue of whether or not this ban on gay men donating blood should be lifted.
Right. And it's giving more impetus to a push that was already underway to try to get the ban lifted. In fact, just last night in Congress, there's word on the Huffington Post that some Congress people started circulating a letter to the FDA saying, you should lift this ban. Here's what Sean Cahill of the Fenway Institute says.
Maybe one positive thing that could come out of this horrible terrorist attack is that people will look at this policy and understand that in a crisis situation like we had in Orlando, you know, we need blood. And I mean, there were plenty of people who were HIV negative who could have donated and they just weren't allowed to donate.
Now, Meghna, I should note there has been enough blood in Orlando. That's what the authorities are saying. The American Red Cross is saying that. The FDA issued a statement saying that, yeah, there is enough blood and, quote, the scientific evidence is not available to support an alternative to the current deferral policy. They say they empathize with the people who might wish to donate and they're committed to reevaluating their policies as new scientific information becomes available.
Interesting. So they have a slightly different view from the other people you talked to about the science, and they're not even addressing the discriminatory charges that people you talk to are saying that the FDA policy has.
Right. My read is they're saying nothing's going to happen right away. Longer term, we'll see.
Well, we will see. Carrie Goldberg is editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. Carrie, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, switching gears for a moment, we've got an important update on the makeup of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. Governor Charlie Baker has just named three new justices to the bench, Superior Court Judges David Lowy, Kimberly Budd, and Frank Gaziano. The two men were first appointed judges by Republican governors, including Governor William Weld and Governor Mitt Romney. And Kimberly Budd is an African-American woman who had been appointed to the Superior Court by Democratic Governor Deval Patrick. David Lowy has been a judge for 19 years and worked with Baker in the Weld administration. His resume also includes 12 years as a vendor at Fenway Park. Kimberly Budd has been a judge for 7 years and previously worked as an attorney at Harvard University and as a federal prosecutor. And Frank Gaziano is a former state and federal prosecutor. The governor's council will schedule confirmation hearings for the three nominees in the coming weeks. We'll bring you more on that as we have it. Well, finally today, as members of the media, permit us a moment for some navel gazing, prompted by this.
You know my opinion of the media. It's very low. I think the media is, frankly, made up of people that, in many cases, not in all cases, are not good people.
Well, that, of course, is Donald Trump, presumptive GOP nominee for president. He was speaking about this a little earlier this year. Well, in a Facebook post just yesterday, Trump sharpened his distaste for the media, specifically the Washington Post, writing, quote, "Based on the incredibly inaccurate coverage and reporting of the record-setting Trump campaign, we are hereby revoking the press credentials of the phony and dishonest Washington Post," end quote. So the Post is banned from the Trump campaign, and it's in good company. The Trump campaign has also given the boot to BuzzFeed, Politico, and the New Hampshire Union Leader, Univision, and the Huffington Post, amongst others. Well, the Post's executive editor, Marty Baron, said in a statement yesterday, quote, "Donald Trump's decision to revoke the Washington Post press credentials is nothing less than a repudiation of the role of a free and independent press." Well, Boston readers are familiar with Marty Baron's unflinching style because he's also the former editor of the Boston Globe. He led the Globe during its Pulitzer Prize-winning expose of the Catholic clergy sex abuse crisis. So we invited Baron to talk with us today. He couldn't join us, but he was in Boston earlier this month at a WBUR event, and he gave a speech about the importance of journalism in modern America, and he touched on the very same themes we see playing out today. So we wanted to play you a moment of that speech about Marty Baron speaking about the role of journalists in a democracy.
There is no assumption that we will always get to the truth, because we know that the truth can be elusive. But there is an assumption that we must be strivers, that we will strive to get things as right as humanly possible, and that when we do all that, we will tell the public what we found. Honestly, honorably, accurately, and fairly, but also unflinchingly. Today, we live in a world where falsehoods proliferate. They corrode the political process. They allow conspiracy theories to take root. And they give rise to politicians who advance agendas by embracing what they know to be lies. In this world, someone must pursue and tell the truth, and that is our obligation as journalists. Our profession depends on it. Our democracy depends on it too. If we expect to enjoy the gift of free expression, we must accept that as our duty, always.
That's Marty Baron, executive editor of the Washington Post, speaking at a WBUR event earlier this month. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.